I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Bruce Van Horn, is that you? Hi there.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm so happy to be talking with you.
Yeah, it's great. Did you get dug out from the big snow?
We are. We're all set.
How much did you get?
Probably between 20 and 24 inches, I think.
Yeah. We wound up with, I think, 17, but about an inch, maybe an inch and a quarter of that was sleet.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. So if had it stayed snow, I think we probably would have been 20 to 22 inches. But
yeah,
the boys just went to school this morning and on a 2-hour delay.
So. Yeah, we had a few days off and a delay also. And it's the kind of thing where you run out of places to put the snow in town.
Right. Well, you have a delay every day, right?
Yeah, I've heard that a few times.
Just once or twice. Could pass it up.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm really excited to have you on. And one of the things I wanted to just personally thank you, you are one of the bright spots on the internet. You are a source of goodness and light and encouragement. And that is the kind of people those are the kind of people I love to spotlight and feature on my show. So I wanted to thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. My pleasure.
And for people who don't know who you are, I wanted to give you a chance to a little bit explain who you are and kind of what the synopsis, not your whole life story, but the synopsis of sort of why, where you are, what got you to where you are, and why you do what you do. I think you have an interesting story, and maybe we can also get into your newest book and your podcast too along the way.
Okay, so where I got into all of this, yes, I do life coaching, I write, I speak, I do my podcast, and all of that is really quite new for me in my life. And the life coaching piece of it came first, and it was not something that I went in search of. And it really is just part of my story where I studied English creative writing in college, really all I ever wanted to be from about the time I was 14, 15 years old was a writer. Mm-hmm. And, so I went off to college. I studied that. That was the early 80s. And, when I think I was a junior in college or maybe late in my sophomore year, the IBM PC, personal computer, came out. Mm-hmm. And my only interest in it was because of this amazing thing called word processing. Mm-hmm. When I went off to college, we went off with a shiny new typewriter. Mm-hmm. And if we were lucky, it was an electric typewriter. Mm-hmm. So this idea that we could type on a computer and correct spelling and without having to retype everything was fascinating to me. And I actually came to understand the computer very, very naturally. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I was offered a job with a division of IBM right out of college. Mm. And I had a writing mentor, professor, who said, Bruce, I'm not so sure about this. I think it's going to be a huge distraction and pull you away from what I believe your real gifts are. And, when you've got a pretty solid job offer that's, where you're going to make a nice amount of money, mm-hmm. First of all, you lie to yourself and you say, it's never going to distract me from my art and, because it's going to give me the financial resources to be able to do what I want. And, 25 years later, I completely forgot that I was ever an English major or that I wanted to be a writer. Yeah. I just got caught up in the typical American dream of chasing the almighty dollar and that happiness and significance and this feeling of inner peace comes from things that are outside of us. Mm-hmm. So I spent my career chasing money, and when I was feeling still empty inside, it was because I didn't have enough. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly looking for pats on the back. I was always looking for people to tell me how awesome I was because I wasn't feeling awesome about myself. Now, I didn't know that that's what I was doing. Mm. But all of my goals in life were goals that kept me on the treadmill of more goal setting. Mm. Because I was always, which is fairly typical, and I work with so many people on their goals now, because you know, if you've set any type of goal and you think that when you achieve that goal, you will feel something, whether it's loved or significant or meaningful or secure or whatever. And if you've set a goal with that as your goal, it's a toxic goal. It will never produce that. You can feel, and I didn't know all of this until much later in my life, but you can feel whatever it is you want to feel right now, because we only experience things in the moment. And at some point, you've got to decide that you are joyful. You've got to decide that you are lovable and start living in that. Well, you know, so my life was, you know, was in that. I started my own business. I did really well in IBM, and that went to my head as a young man, and I started my own business. It lasted about 2 years, and I lost everything. Wow. Wound up filing bankruptcy when I was 27, maybe early into my 28th year. And that was a major blow to my ego. And in the meantime, I had gotten married to someone I had. We grew up together. We'd known each other since we were 10 years old, and it was just a convenience. It was just a comfortable thing to do, and that was a very, very difficult marriage for a lot of different reasons. And to her credit, you know, a lot of it was beyond her control. I did not necessarily realize it. Although there were lots of warning signs looking back, but she suffered from severe mental illness and did a really good job of keeping that hidden most of her life. She still has schizophrenia and was hearing voices from the time she was about 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And so that was difficult. She was in and out of medical hospitals. She was in and out of psychiatric hospitals. All of our adult lives, we gave birth to our first son in 1997, and that went great. He's now just about to turn 19 years old, and I have a boy who turns 13 in 2 weeks. Mm. But in between, we gave birth to our daughter, and she passed away tragically, and spent 8 days in ICU, and I was grossly underinsured. The medical bills were well over $1 million.
Wow.
And we lost that battle, sadly. And you know, because I was grossly underinsured, my share of it was several $100,000. And I tried for a couple of years to dig out from under that and just couldn't. So when I was 41, I filed bankruptcy again. Mm-hmm. You know, and for a guy who is looking to for his sense of self-worth and his identity and his ability to provide for his family financially, to have a second blow like that was just really difficult. And so I found myself at 42 years old just hating waking up every morning.
Wow.
I was unhappy. I was cynical. I was sarcastic. Mm. I had given up hope that my life would ever be good, that I was just going through the motions every single day and just hoping on any given day that today won't be as bad as yesterday was, but without any real expectation that it would. And if good things did happen to me, I had this mindset, well, you know, we aren't going to celebrate that because it certainly won't last very long. Mm. And when you've got that sort of expectation from life, that is what you wind up attracting into your life. And again, I didn't know any of that. But in November of 2005, I had just turned 42 years old. My older brother, who's a year and a half older than I am, he came to Richmond, Virginia, which is where I live. He came to run the Richmond Marathon. And at that point, it was the darkest period of my life. While I wasn't doing anything specifically in that direction, I was seriously considering taking my life. I was that miserable. He came to town, ran the Richmond Marathon, and later that evening, he said, "Bruce, you should do this." And I said, "I should do what?" And he said, "You should run marathons." And I laughed at him and I said, no, I work from home. I'm overweight. I'm out of shape. And I don't even like to drive 26 miles unless I'm, unless I'm going on vacation, because everything that I want is within a 10-minute drive of my house. So unless I'm going on vacation, I don't even like to drive 26 miles. And then he said a phrase that not that night, but later on, it would be the phrase that came to change my life and literally save my life. Mm. He said, Bruce, the hardest part about running a marathon is making the decision to do it. Mm. And I did not believe the man. I was pretty sure that the hardest part about running a marathon was the running part, which I was not equipped or prepared, nor did I even really want to do it. But his words sort of hung in the back of my head. And over the next couple weeks, I decided, you know what, if my older brother can run marathons, I could at least join the gym and start trying to lose a little extra weight and be in better shape so that I can play with my two sons, who were then 8 and 2 at the time, because I was getting out of breath after 10 minutes of riding bikes with them. So I joined the gym. I started walking on a treadmill. Then I started jogging a little bit and mixing the jogging and walking. And I set a goal of being able to jog 1 mile on a treadmill without walking. I didn't think I'd ever hit that goal, Lisa. It just took weeks and weeks and weeks. But I finally did. And when I did finally jog 1 mile without walking, something in me clicked. And it was only a week later that I was able to jog 2 miles. And I noticed that I was really starting to enjoy this jogging thing. And while I hated every other aspect of my life, I was finding myself looking forward to getting up in the morning to go to the gym. Because it was really the first time in my life, or at least my adult life, that I was doing something just for me. Yeah. I was taking care of Bruce. I spent all of my life taking care of my wife, my kids, my businesses, my employees, and you know, everybody. It was all about everybody else, and Bruce was totally empty. And so this was finally me doing something just for me, and I felt guilty about that too, and I had a little help in feeling guilty about it too. But you know, again, that was just from, you know, her aspect of the way she was experiencing life. And but I started jogging more. It was now getting to be spring in 2006. I ran in a neighborhood 5K, and that was a lot of fun. Then I ran a month later in a 10K, and that was fun. And at that point, I decided to take my brother's challenge and train for a marathon. So I went from 10K to marathon training, and it was in that process of training for my first marathon that I had a major epiphany. And in November of 2006, in August of 2006, I was out for a 18-mile long run. And I was in marathon shape. I had totally transformed my body. I was no longer out of shape. I was no longer overweight. I was a marathon runner. And while I had not yet run my first marathon, in my mind, I was a marathon runner. And I was really enjoying it. And I was out early one morning running. And I had this epiphany that literally brought me to a stop in the middle of the road with tears in my eyes. Because it occurred to me that my brother was right all along. The hardest part about running a marathon is making the decision to do it. But I misunderstood him. I thought it was a decision that you make once. And it occurred to me that it's a decision that you have to make every single day to change your life. If there's something that you want, you've got to decide every single day to do what it takes to change your life. And earlier that morning, I was still grumpy and surly and pessimistic about every other aspect of my life. And if you had said to me, Bruce, what's your problem? I would have been able to rattle off for you a long list of exactly what was wrong in my life with an equally corresponding list of who was to blame for it. So there were people to blame, there were governments, economies, there was even God to blame. Bruce was nowhere on that list. Bruce was a total victim and finger pointer. And it occurred to me then that here I am, though. I'm out on an 18-mile training run. I have totally transformed my body. And the only way I was able to do that was by deciding to do it. And it occurred to me that if I could totally transform my body by making the decision and thinking the thoughts necessary, because I also realized that in order to train for a marathon, you've got to let go of any self-talk that says, I can't do this. You've got to eliminate criticism. You've got to eliminate any kind of negative self-talk. And I was the king of negative self-talk with every other area of my life. But once I started this, I was all, you can do this, Bruce, you can do this. And when your feet are screaming and saying, Bruce, it's time to stop. We're bleeding down here. You literally have blisters that are bleeding. If the mind says, you know what, this is stupid, the body says, hallelujah, I've been telling you that for the last 5 miles. And your body will stop. But if the body can be screaming and saying, no, we're done, Bruce. But if the mind and the will says, no, feet, you know what? We've got another 3 more miles to go, and we're going to do it. The feet will begrudgingly go the extra 3 miles. So that's what occurred to me, was that everything, I had to claim 100% responsibility in order to change my physical health.
Yeah.
It also occurred to me that I had to claim 100% responsibility to change everything else about my life.
I was just about to say that it was about you. You claimed 100% for your physical health, but then not quite for the rest of it. And one of the other things that struck me, because I've been really listening to a lot of your podcasts, which we'll get to in a minute, but that you talk about not complaining, or that, you know, you complaints might happen along the way, but that you know, you're not going to listen to your body complaining, and you're going to just be responsible for the training you need to do. And I think that's such an important point, to put complaints aside. And it's just an excellent thing. The self-talk and the complaints can really creep in, and then it will sideline us in terms of responsibility.
Absolutely. One of my favorite quotes about that comes from a guy named Peter Sage, and he's a motivational speaker and business coach. And his quote that I tweet out a lot on Twitter just says that complaints are the glue that keep you stuck to your problems.
How true, yeah.
You know, it's complaining. And so I set about, I had this revelation that I could apply the same type of thinking that I had done for my body to the other areas of my life. And so I started with gratitude. And I was not thankful for anything. And I started reading a lot of personal development books. I read Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, which I didn't understand at all the first 3 times I read it. you know, but there was something in that book that he said, you know, to start off every single day by expressing gratitude for what you have. And that when you express gratitude for what you have, it makes it easier to get what you want. And so I did not believe the man, but I, just like my brother, at this point, I absolutely believed in the benefit of doing something daily, a daily discipline. And so I sat down at my kitchen table every single day, and I started making a list of 5 things for which I was grateful every single morning. And when I was making these lists, they were trivial things. Like I'm thankful for coffee. I'm thankful for a bowl of mini wheats. I'm thankful for, you know, a kitchen table and chair to sit at. But I was writing these things with absolute insincerity, because I was not, in fact, grateful for them. I felt entitled to them. And, you know, but I kept writing down things like that. And it was about a month later that I was looking back over my list and realizing that I was still writing down the same trivial things, but I was starting to feel a little different. Hmm. I was actually starting to feel grateful for the cup of coffee and for the bowl of mini wheats. And what occurred to me was that, what if somebody came in the middle of the night and stole my coffee maker or cleaned out my pantry and took out my bowl of mini wheats or the box of mini wheats and the gallon of milk? Well, I would miss those things. Mm-hmm. And that's what occurred to me, that's what gratitude is appreciating it in your life and that you would miss it if it was gone. Mm. And then I had another revelation, Lisa. I'd been writing this gratitude journal for a month now, 30 days. And I looked back over my list, and at this point I was still married and I had two healthy boys. Guess what was not on my list? Mm. At no point did my boys make it on my list or my wife. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me, well, what if I woke up tomorrow and they weren't here? Mm. And then I remembered my daughter. Mm. And so gratitude sort of came sweeping into my life at that point. And just like running, I started looking forward to getting up every morning and writing in my gratitude journal. And I started noticing things in my life that I had taken for granted and was really appreciating them. I would look at things and say, well, what if that was gone? Mm. And so that's... So my gratitude journal sort of grew into just general journaling, which became very cathartic for me. I mm-hmm. got into it. It actually awakened in me again my love for writing and for expressing things. And I actually even found a lot of the things that I had written in college and in high school, and the short stories that I was writing were about this type of transformation. I was writing even when I was a teen about people in situations who overcame difficult odds and changed the way they looked at life, relationships that got turned around. And you know, it was just so funny. And so this process started changing me. Mm-hmm. And in the process, I also realized that I had to change a lot of my language. I had to just eliminate sarcasm. Mm. From my language. Sarcasm is not cute. Mm. I still encounter a lot of people who strongly defend their use of sarcasm.
Well, Bruce, do you find that sarcasm is toxic? Like, what about sarcasm?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's a difference. It's not funny. You know, sarcasm is almost always, well, it is always derisive. Mm. You know, it is always cutting. It is always belittling of someone else, a situation, or of yourself. Mm. And that's never healthy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just never healthy. You know, when somebody does, you know, something and you say, oh, well, that was a smooth move.
Yeah, I guess someone's always on the losing end of it, even if it's you and someone else, but it's towards someone else who isn't there. You know, you're doing it to bond with someone. Someone's always on the losing end of sarcasm.
And there's always something positive that I've learned you can say. And so in the meantime, after, you know, my relationships started changing, my marriage was still very difficult, but I wound up eliminating some friends from my life because I realized that I was changing, but they weren't, and my associating with them was toxic and unhealthy for me. Mm. I started hanging around new people, happier, healthier people, people who were living the type of life that I wanted to be living. Mm. And so I shifted my focus to where I wanted to go and what I wanted in my life rather than looking back at all of the pain and the tragedy that I had been through in my life. And there was a gentleman whose son was the same age as mine, and we had been just soccer field dads for probably 7 or 8 years. We had known each other, it seemed like forever. Mm-hmm. But we weren't close. You know, we just, our kids played soccer, and that was about it. That's all we ever saw each other. Well, one summer he came over to me And this was probably, well, it's 2015 now, so this would be around 2010. Well, it's 2016. Yeah, so 2010 or 2011, I forget. Mm-hmm. And he came up to me and he said, "Bruce, there's something different about you. I've known you for a long time. And the way you interact with the kids, the way you interact with other parents is different this year. What's going on?" Mm-hmm. And so I started telling him about what I had experienced in my life. And he said, "Well, whatever it is that you've got, I want that." And I, you know, "Would you consider being my life coach?"
Wow.
And I had never even heard the phrase life coach before. That was a brand new term for me. Hmm. And I said, "What in the world is a life coach?" And he said, he told me what his idea of it was. I said, "Well, that really just sort of sounds like a cross between a psychotherapist and a best friend." And I'm willing to be the best friend. I don't think I'm qualified to be the psychotherapist. But he said, "Nope, I want to pay you. And I want, you know," so we met at Starbucks once a week for several months, and he gave me $20 each time. Mm-hmm. But it created a real relationship. And I just started sharing with him the things that I was doing. And in the process of doing that, he noticed it right away. And I noticed that when I was working with him, I came alive. It was what I was born to do. Mm-hmm. And I later wound up talking to another friend of mine who I hadn't seen in about 20 years. And he was just catching him up on what I do now. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Oh, well, that's a no-brainer." Said, "Even in high school, you were always the guy we could come to, you know, for insight or advice on our lives. And I didn't remember that." And so that's sort of how I got into life coaching. And this this guy referred me to two other friends of his, none of whom lived in Richmond. One lived in Philadelphia, one lived in Boston. And so I started meeting with them over the phone. Then we shifted over to meeting via Skype. And then they referred me to a couple more people. The guy who I was meeting with here in Richmond, he wound up moving. And he actually is the only life coaching client I've ever had locally where I've met face to face. And so now I have clients all over the world, and it's just really become, you know, the joy of my life. And I got back into writing. And, you know, then at the time that I thought my life was going to go exactly where I wanted it to go, things were going really well. I had made for safety reasons, my wife's mental health significantly deteriorated to the point where it was not safe for her to be around the boys just because of the voices she was hearing. So I got divorced. The boys and I got through that drama and trauma of all of that, and we had sort of really hit our stride of three guys living in the same house together, and, you know, life without mom, and adjusting to that, developing some new ways of communicating. We had developed very unhealthy communication skills, partly because I was always protecting them from her, and they were just never sure who they could be around their mom. And so we had to undo all of that. And so we were finally to the point where life was really good. My career was going the way I wanted it to go. I had just turned 50 years old. And on February 17th at 9:22, February 17th of 2014 at 9:22 in the morning, my phone rang. And I was expecting the call, so I knew when I rolled it over and looked at the caller ID, I knew exactly who it was. I had been writing in my gratitude journal and eating my bowl of mini wheats that morning, and I knew what, or I saw who it was. I had had some blood work done the week before, and I was actually, I had had a biopsy done the week before and was expecting the results. But the doctor said, "You know what? This all looks very, very good to me. So I don't expect anything difficult or upsetting to come from this. So just enjoy your weekend and I'll call you on Monday." Well, he didn't call me on Monday. So February 17th was a Tuesday. I looked at my phone. I saw the time. I just put my youngest on the bus, and I had a moment of clarity. I knew before I even answered the phone exactly what he was going to tell me. And I knew that eating breakfast that morning would be the last normal thing I'd do for a very, very long time. Mm. And when your doctor calls you and he's holding back tears, it's not good. He said, Bruce, you have got serious stage 4 prostate cancer. Mm. It is very aggressive. And so my life became a whirlwind of just dealing with that. And, you know, so test after test and making decisions and deciding on treatment options. And, you know, everybody I met, prostate cancer is like most forms of cancer, but prostate cancer is extremely treatable with lots and lots of treatment options if it's caught early. Mm. And mine was not. And so I elected to have what's called a radical retropubic prostatectomy, which is the very, very invasive surgery. And so on April 7th, I had my surgery, and what was supposed to just be an hour and a half surgery and one night in the hospital and then just recovering at home. When I woke up from that surgery, pretty quickly was able to figure out that something had gone wrong. Mm. And from the stories that I later heard, I almost passed on the operating table. I lost over 70% of my blood during the surgery through no fault of my surgeon. Absolutely love my surgeon. He saved my life. But I had an anatomic anomaly that had to be dealt with and wrapped around, most men don't have it, but wrapped around my prostate was a huge bundle of blood vessels.
Oh, wow.
And there are two goals in prostate surgery for young men. Let's get the cancer, let's remove the prostate, but we also need to do whatever we can to protect the nerves that are wrapped around the prostate, because those are the nerves that control male functioning. And he had promised me he would do everything that he could to protect that. And another surgeon might have said, you know what, we're busy, we're backed up. I had blocked off an hour and a half for this, and it's been almost 5 hours on the operating table. We're just going to cauterize these blood vessels because, you know, I don't want to operate in blood. But my surgeon didn't do that. He said, I made a promise to Bruce. And so he had to cut each of the blood vessels and let me bleed while he did the work. And then he went back and hand sutured all of the blood vessels because you can't cauterize blood vessels that are wrapped around nerves that we're trying to spare.
Wow.
But because of that, my recovery from surgery was brutal.
Hmm.
Because there's one thing, you know, when you go to hospitals to have surgery, there's this really cool stuff that they give you called drugs. And guess what they could not give me?
Oh, wow.
So I had to do major abdominal surgery with zero pain medication. And so I had to figure out how to do this. Mm. And it was actually what wound up birthing my book called Worry No More. Mm. And because I learned how to practice mindfulness, mindfulness to the extreme, where I literally was taking one breath at a time.
Mm.
And, you know, so I would breathe in, I would breathe out, and I'd say, okay, Bruce, you took a breath, you didn't die. Mm. Let's do one more, just like it. I didn't count them. I didn't string them together. I didn't think about previous breaths. I didn't think about future breaths. I just focused on this one breath. And then about 2 days into doing that, falling in and out of fitful sleep, they were still trying to give me pain or sleeping medication to sort of keep me out of it. But it was during one of those breath cycles that I had another epiphany that if I was able to breathe, now here I am in extreme pain, I could go back into victim mode. I certainly could. But I had chosen not to do that. I had told myself a story, and I told my boys a story that we would get through this one way or another, but, you know, I would assume responsibility for my recovery. But I also discovered that in the ability to take a breath, Lisa, it proves beyond the shadow of a doubt that in this moment, if you can breathe, you have, or, you know, for me, I personalized it. I have in this moment everything I need. Because if you can hear my voice, you know, that means you have the gift of hearing. You don't need to hear in order to be alive. And while we're not doing the video piece of this, if we were, you would be able to see me. We'd be able to see each other. You don't have to have the gift of sight to be able to live. Helen Keller didn't have either. Mm-hmm. She lived a beautifully productive, wonderful life. Mm-hmm. I could smell the gauze and the antiseptics. I could smell the lady wheeling the meal cart down the hall in the mm-hmm. in the hospital, bypassing my room because I wasn't able to eat anything. I was on an intravenous feed. Mm-hmm. But if I could smell of all of that, I had the gift of smell. And I could feel the pain in my stomach, but it also occurred to me that there are people in this world who are born without any sense of physical touch or without any feeling. Mm. And they can stick their hand in a fire and not feel it, and that's dangerous. And so this pain that I'm in is actually a gift. Mm. It's not a curse. And I knew that that would pass eventually. Mm. And so again, it just... this wave of gratitude came over me that this is not something to bemoan. This is not something to be upset about. Somehow, in some way, this experience is a gift. Mm. And so it was from there I just sort of moved on and told myself this story. I focused on where I wanted to be. I still had this dream of what I wanted for my life. And cancer and a difficult recovery was just a roadblock. It wasn't a complete stop. It wasn't, you know, it was a detour rather than a roadblock. And I just had to get around this. And so I started that practice of doing it. Mm. And so...
And that was the kind of germ for what you eventually wrote your book, Worry No More.
Exactly.
Hmm. And maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the concepts in that book that I know one of them is about, you know, I don't know if this is in it. I haven't read it yet, but worry is a lot like meditation done wrong, I think.
It is, yeah.
You know? And if we can all worry, we can all meditate, you know.
Exactly.
And I think you kind of go there with that.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Everything. See, absolutely everything about our lives, Lisa, we only experience what our entire life experience is experienced through the vehicle of thought mm-hmm. in this moment, mm-hmm. okay? And because of that, we are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every day of our life, we are telling ourselves a story. Mm-hmm. We are literally scripting the movie of our lives. And, you know, I love to go see movies, but there has never been a movie produced in Hollywood. You know, I love Steven Spielberg. He's a great director and has created some of the greatest movies, but he's not capable of reproducing anything with the creativity, with the vivid design set, or the plot line of the story you have created for your life. We cast ourselves in roles. We write our scripts. We cast other people in their roles, and we write their scripts. We tell ourselves a story about who and what we are. We tell ourselves a story about what the future is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And that's what worry is. Mm-hmm. Worry is you telling yourself a story about what you don't want to happen. Mm-hmm. And you can just as easily tell a different story. You could take this, whatever situation it is. So if you're worried that you can't, that you have no money in your bank account, you have no idea how you're going to pay rent next month. Well, you can tell yourself, some people will say, well, that's a legitimate thing to be worried about. Well, maybe. But if you're telling yourself a story in which you see yourself getting evicted, then you're not going to take the action necessary to do anything about it.
Hmm.
But if you tell yourself a story in which you see yourself writing that check and you see yourself taking on extra income or eliminating some expenses, then your body will go through the motions to make those things come true. Mm. And so that's mm-hmm. a big part of the book, Worry No More, is just reminding everybody that everything you're telling yourself is a story.
Mm. And so at what point did you begin your podcast, Life is a Marathon? At what point? Because you have hundreds of episodes at this point, don't you?
Yeah, I recorded yesterday episode 206.
That's a lot, yeah.
And so just over a year, it goes out usually 3 days a week. Mm. And I started it on September 14th of 2014, so probably 7 months after my surgery, my cancer surgery. And I had people tell me that I should do a podcast prior to me getting cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those things that was like, yeah, that sounds great. But I just wasn't very excited about it. And everything I understand is perfect in our lives. And so it wasn't meant for me to do a podcast then. And had I started my podcast before, I would have had to put it on hold for so long. I put everything about my life. Mm-hmm. I literally put my entire life coaching practice on hold. Everything other than getting well again mm-hmm. is where I focused my attention. But then when I came back from it, I came back strong and I realized that I had a story, that I had discovered my voice and how I could communicate with people. So I started it, and my podcast has been arguably probably one of the most rewarding things I have ever done in my life. I'm listened to in 194 countries around the world.
Wow.
I get messages from people from countries where English is absolutely not the spoken language. Mm-hmm. It would probably be dangerous for them to be listening to my podcast publicly. Mm-hmm. But I get so many emails from all over the world thanking me for I just tell it like it is. Mm-hmm. I just tell my story and I try to be encouraging to people, and I tell people about how I perceive life mm-hmm. these days. Mm-hmm. And I use the metaphor of life as a marathon. And so we are constantly training for whatever it is. So that's how I started it. It's been great, and yeah.
Oh, that's great. I don't want to keep you too much longer because I know you have, you might have an 11 o'clock appointment, but I hope that if people want to get a hold of you, what is the best way to do that?
Well, I made this great arrangement with Google mm-hmm. that if you just go to Google and type in Bruce Van Horn, I'm pretty findable. There actually are one or two other Bruce Van Horns. There's mm-hmm. actually a Bruce Van Horn who's written a bunch of books about yoga. That's not me. but everybody else is – everything else is me. So mm-hmm. it will bring you to brucevanhorn.com mm-hmm. is my website. Lifeisamarathon.com is mm-hmm. is my podcast. But brucevanhorn.com is the hub for everything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm on Twitter. Twitter has been so mm-hmm. much fun and so good to me. I've got 416,000 Twitter
yes.
followers. And I am one of the most retweeted people on Twitter every single day. It's just mm-hmm. crazy.
It is. You really are. You put a lot of good content out there, and I've always appreciated your stuff.
Well, thank you.
You've been on for quite a while on Twitter, too.
I have, long before my surgery. So,
yeah.
and that was amazing, too, because the love and support that I have gotten from people, you know, long before I started my podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I sent out a tweet just asking people to pray for me, mm-hmm. you know, the day or so after I got my diagnosis. Mm-hmm. And I got hundreds and hundreds of tweets from people I don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so encouraging to build these real relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the people who started following me that I started interacting with on Twitter are now some of my best friends.
Oh, yeah.
So it really has connected us in a very meaningful way.
Well, I will also include all of those links and important links in your to your book and everything on the show notes for this podcast. But have you ever used the platform Blab for doing anything? Because that might be fun to try that with you.
I just started using Blab. I would love to do that with you. I do Periscope. Mm-hmm. I do at least one or two Periscopes a week, and that has been a lot of fun. But I've done a couple Blabs, and it's absolutely something I want to start doing more.
Yeah, I have one that I'll be doing at 8 o'clock tonight, actually. But yeah, that would be fun. Maybe we'll be able to schedule something sometime in the future.
That's
kind of my favorite. I love doing the recorded ones, but the live stuff where I can see.
Yes.
People and actually feel the energy and interact. That's kind of my favorite. So maybe we can plan something for the future, Bruce. I just really appreciate you and all the positivity
that.
And the energy and goodwill you put into the world. It's just, I just wanted to connect with you so badly.
Well, I appreciate that. And I hope that you know that the work that you're doing is literally changing the world. It really is. You know, the fact that you are spreading optimism and hope and, you know, the whole spark my muse is just such a beautiful idea. So I hope that you are getting the feedback from the universe that the work you're doing is meaningful and it's changing lives. I believe in this butterfly effect that, you know, one kind word to somebody literally changes the universe.
Yeah, I agree.
Forever. Mm-hmm. So thank you for you and the work that you're doing too.
Yeah, amen. I'll be in touch with you. I appreciate that. So good. Have a wonderful day, Bruce. And I appreciate
your
story. And I'm really delighted that whatever suffering that you have had has been redeemed in so many different ways. It's just lovely. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I hope you have a beautiful day too. And let's stay connected.
Absolutely.
This has been fun.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.